Gentlemen, be so good. Good morning. Welcome to the Saturday morning session of the How Class Works Conference. Before we get going, I have just a couple of announcements. The Working Class Studies Association business meeting is this afternoon during the lunch period from 12:45 to 1:45. So anybody who's a member of the Working Class Studies Association, please be there. There's $10 in it for you. The rule of the Working Class Studies Association is if you're a member, one of the benefits is that you get a $10 rebate towards the registration fees for the conference. So I happen to have a stack of $10 bills. So Working Class Studies Association people, that's not enough. We got some business to do to build this organization and make sure that we can thrive and continue to grow. So please do come. And if you're not a member, you're welcome to come as well. It's just not $10 in it for you just yet. That meeting is at 12:45. The room is in the program. I can't remember exactly what. It's up on the third floor. So get your lunch in the cafeteria. You can bring it upstairs or you can have your lunch first and then come up, however you want to do that. If you have gotten financial aid from the conference or from the Working Class Studies Association, you have to see Dan Woolman, who I think all of you know out by the registration table or wandering around, because we have paperwork for you to fill out in order for you to get your support. So that's a very important piece of business for us to make sure we get done while you're here, because all that paperwork has to be done by the end of this month, and we have to do it because the fiscal year ends, it's June 30th and everything, and the fiscal situation, we want to spend it while we've got it. This morning, our plenary is devoted really to a central question of what we're doing with charter schools, what does this charter school movement mean? Before we get into that, going to have a couple of tunes from at least Brian, who's going to get us going the way that we ought to be going.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Buenos dias. Assalamu alaikum. Howdy. Good morning to our panelists. I had a couple of songs that were on my mind after last night, particularly during the dinner. And so I want you to join me in singing the song. Those of you who weren't able to come last night know this. I am not a singer-musician. I'm a choral director and a cultural worker. So I never sing alone. I always sing with others. So, that's right. So this is, no, I don't care if your big club teacher told you not to sing. I don't care if the nuns told you to stand in the back of the room, just move your lips. I don't care if the rabbi threw both hands with oy vey gadug. I don't care if your children were screaming from the nursery. No mommy, no daddy, don't sing again. Please don't sing again. This is not about whether you can carry a tune in a bucket, brothers and sisters. This is about communion. Com, the Latin word for with. Union, the Latin word for one. So when we sing together, we are in communion. You got it?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, so you may not know this, but I always sing songs that are easy, repeatable, et cetera, et cetera. And most of them, like Joe Hill's songs, are based on popular songs, either culturally popular songs or talk songs that came out of the African-American gospel tradition. So this is the first one. And I want to dedicate it to the teachers that made it possible for me to stand here before you today. In particular, my mentors, High Thornblum and Joyce Lewis Corman. So I want you to think about the ones that help you to get over, the ones that brought you here. You can call their name out loud, you can just say it in your own mind. And not just the teachers, but all the people who made it possible for us to be sitting in this room together today. May the work that I have done speak for me. From Milton Rogolin. May the work that I have done speak for me. Francis Fox Bidman. If I fall short of my goal, someone else will take a hold. May the work that I have done speak for me. Ready? That's the people's key, because that's my key, okay? I'm a tenor, this shouldn't be any problem for the tenors. Basses, it might be a little, you know, a little high. If you want, you can drop down there to a very white range of your voice. And for altos, it shouldn't be a problem either. I used to be an alto before the cigarettes and the beer. And sopranos, might be a little low for you. Go for that octave, okay? Go ahead.
May the work that I have done speak for me. May the work that I have done speak for me.
If I fall short of my goal.
If I fall short of my goal, someone else will take a hold. May the work that I have done speak for me.
Now, I notice there are people who are doing that Charlie McCarthy thing and singing with their lips closed. But I don't know if you know, but Charlie, even the guy who ran, you know, Charlie McCarthy had to like move his lips a little bit. So I'm going to do it again, and this time I'm going to say, may the students I have taught speak for me. You ready?
May the students I have taught speak for me.
I can't hear you, panelists.
May the students I have taught speak for me.
If I fall short of my goal.
If I fall short of my goal, someone else will take a hold. May the students I have taught speak for me.
May the marches I've been on.
May the marches I've been on speak for me. May the marches I've been on speak for me.
If I fall short of my goal.
If I fall short of my goal, someone else will take a hold. May the marches I've been on speak for me.
May the work I've done for all those who went before us.
May the work that I have done speak for me.
For the ancestors who came on the boats.
May the work that I have done speak for me.
For the First Nations people who were here when they arrived.
If I fall short of my goal, someone else will take a hold. May the work that I have done speak for me.
I think that's enough.
Before we get any further, and just listen to Elise and looking around and who's in the room and who's been at this conference, I just have to say I know you appreciate what I've been doing, but I can't tell you that this cannot have happened without you and the work that you do, and I'm so pleased to have everybody here to carry this on. So, thank you. So, the work in front of us this morning has to do with charter schools. We have three people here who know something about it, who've done a thing or two on the question, and I'm just going to say who they are, one sentence about each, and then it's their show. We will be done here at 10:30 and then break and go upstairs. The pastries can go with you. There will be more setups upstairs, so we'll do that. We have Camilla Jarvis here over on the far end, who's the Chicago school teacher, was in the public, in a charter school, didn't like the way it was going, thought it'd be a good idea to have a union, ran into a management bus stop, and ended up having a union after all. So. Leo Casey, who's the vice president of the United Federation of Teachers, vice president for high schools, and also works in the UFT, directing their organizing efforts for charter schools in the New York City area, in New York City, where UFT organizes. And each one of those is a full-time job. And we were hoping to get a pamphlet out of this and have these presentations written up, and Leo said this morning, he doesn't have it written up, because it would be much easier to have done it if he wasn't fighting for 5,000 teachers' jobs while trying to prepare for this. We all know what kind of an environment we're in, and it's just terrific that we have people here who are still in that fight. Nancy Van Meter is Vice President of the American Federation of Teachers from Washington. One of her responsibilities is to help give guidance to the AFT and their national campaigns around organizing for charter schools. And that's enough for you to know about these people without any further ado. Here they are.
Eat the mic. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. I know this is a big room, so but nobody ever accused me of not having a teacher's voice. So I was saying, I hope when our panel is done today, that you will have a much richer appreciation for why the topic that we are discussing is at the very center of the future of public education in this country and the future of trade unionism in this country. Charter schools are not a discrete or isolated phenomenon. They are not something which happens over here as a sideshow to the rest of what is happening in public education. Charter schools are at the very center of an effort to transform American education into a market-based system. They are at the very center of a neoliberal vision of remaking of public education in the United States. And so when we discuss charter schools, we are discussing all of education. And in many different ways in New York City, that has become apparent in real stark ways over the last few months. We have seen in New York City millions and millions of dollars, is the only way to describe this, millions and millions of dollars, which has been funneled through a group called Education Reform Now, which is run and financed entirely by hedge fund operators off of Wall Street, which has run a campaign against the teacher union and against public education around the race to the top competition. It has been, in part, a campaign to raise the cap on charter schools, to increase the number of charter schools without any significant reforms, which we can discuss what they are. But it has also been a campaign that has taken the opportunity, and that's how they see it, the opportunity of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the prospect that thousands and thousands of teachers could be laid off, to run a campaign to eliminate seniority-based layoffs, to allow principals complete discretion to get rid of whomever they and their superiors in the Department of Education would like in the name of layoffs. And you, if you are a resident of New York City, you could well have received in your mailbox a very glossy, very slick public relations document which said the teacher union is trying to get your child's favorite teacher fired. And the basis of that was that we insist that if you do layoffs, you do layoffs in seniority order. There has been television advertisements on a mass scale. There has been the promotion of alternative organizations. The notion of AstroTurf organizing has received new meaning in the context of VR. There is a group that was created specifically this year of quote-unquote teachers, led by two Teach for America folks, completely financed by Education Reform Now and these hedge fund operators, to go after the layoff order that really precedes teacher unions, that goes back to civil service law. So that's one aspect of what's happening. The second aspect, and this may surprise you to find this out, the biggest source of foundation money for charter schools in New York State is not the Gates Foundation. It's not the Broad Foundation. It's a foundation called the Walton Family Foundation. Yeah. The Walton Family Foundation is the foundation of Walmart. Now, before Walmart did this, its sole contribution to American education is being the biggest violator of child labor laws in the United States. And so you may ask yourself, why did the Walton Walmart nexus decide that it was important to become involved in charter schools in New York State? And the answer I suggest to you is that there remains in an American labor movement that has been on the defensive and on the decline for three decades, there remains only one sector of the American economy which is organized, and that is K-12 education. And teacher unions have become a proportionately more important part of the American labor movement as the great industrial unions have been on decline. And the sole reason for the Walmart Foundation to be involved in New York around charter schools is to strike what they would consider to be a final death blow against teacher unionism and trade unionism to ensure that they themselves will never be organized. And thirdly, just to give you a complete picture here. We have in New York City a situation where the main organization of charter management, the New York City Charter School Center, has on its board the Chancellor of the Department of Education, Joel Klein. And you have the picture of someone who has supposedly led New York City public schools for the last 8 years, attacking his own schools in favor of establishing charter schools. We had a huge battle this year over the mass closing of public schools in New York City, 19 schools he slated for closure. And we were able to stop that this year by taking him to court because he had failed to follow the governance law regarding the closing of schools. And that has created great havoc for him, because closing schools in New York City, and I have to say this is probably true in other parts of the country as well, but closing schools in New York City is not an educational issue. It's not done on an educational basis. They provide ex post facto educational justifications. But knowing those schools intimately, I can tell you that at least half of those schools do not deserve to be closed. Closing schools in New York City is to create space to open charter schools. It's part of a project to remake the face of public education. And it is the leadership in New York City, of the ostensible leadership of New York City public schools, say the same about Washington, D.C., and many other different cities across the country, that is very much involved in that project. And this is a perversion of the original vision of charter schools. I'm not going to talk about that. Nancy's going to talk about that. But this is clearly a perversion of the original mission of charter schools. And it is a perversion into a vision of educational reform, which has two axes, and charter schools are at the center of both of them. The first is an axis of privatization. There is an attempt here to take one of the remaining important components of the public square, one of the remaining important parts of American public life, and privatize it. There is a vision of charter schools here, which is different from the original vision, which is one basically of private schools that are funded with public money. And there are a number of dimensions of that. There is the fact that in New York City, one of the things that we've clearly established in this debate is that charter schools are not serving the high-need students that go to public schools. There are many fewer English language learners. There are many fewer students with special needs. There are many fewer students living in poverty. There is the fact that charter schools in New York City have been, in many cases, run by for-profit management companies that take as much as 25 cents of every dollar that's supposed to go to the schools and the students out of public money. There is the problem that there is a lack of transparency for a so-called public institution so that one can see what's being done, a lack of accountability. And finally, and most importantly, in New York City and New York State, there has been a systematic attempt to deny parent voice and teacher voice in charter schools. And so there is an attempt to make charter schools into what are in fact private schools supported with public money. The second axis of the reform, and I think this is equally important, is one of the de-skilling and the deprofessionalization of teaching. This is very much connected to the model of Teach for America, that rather than teaching being a lifetime commitment, a lifetime vocation, it is something that you do like you would do the Peace Corps. You take 2 or 3 years of your life at the beginning, you go and do your noblesse oblige, and you go on to your life as a lawyer, as a stock market financier, whatever you want to. And there is a model of how you do education that's involved in this. It is a model of complete churning of the workforce. There is a remarkably high teacher turnover in charter schools, much higher than district schools, where it is still a problem. And in order to compensate for the fact that you then have basically an unskilled teaching force, because teaching is a remarkably, remarkably complicated set of skills, particularly with young people, where you cannot count on them sitting still while you sit and lecture. And it takes a good 2 to 3 years under optimum conditions for someone to learn and master the skills of teaching. And if you're leaving at the end of the 3rd or 4th year, what you have is the a teaching force which becomes de-skilled. And the way in which this is compensated for is that you begin to extend the school day, extend the school week, extend the school year, create schools that are increasingly a boot camp mentality. And you put in teacher-proof curriculums in which teachers are just supposed to follow the script and do what they say. And that model is all one element connected to the other. And it has a particular set of economic benefits. Because even though charter schools largely pay, at least now, the wage scale for the district schools in the city, because they just simply couldn't get teachers otherwise, they're paying the wage scale for much more time. They're not providing the same pension benefits. And they're not providing the same health care benefits. And even if they're paying the scale, teachers never get very far along the scale because it's 4 years and they're gone. So you have these two axes of the reform effort. On the one hand, privatization. On the other hand, the de-skilling of teaching. And charter schools are at the center of both of them. Now, it is also, I think, important to understand that there is a conscious strategy. And for those of you who have a background in Leninism, none of us here without, of course. But for those of you who read Lenin in your youth, you'll remember that his in one of his texts, I believe it was State Revolution, he laid out a strategy for how you transform society, which he called the dual power strategy. So you create an alternative state, you undermine the existing state, and your alternative state eventually has that site of dual power replaces the existing state. The charter school folks, the hedge fund folks, Walmart, are bourgeois Leninists. They have a dual power strategy. And their strategy is to create an alternative system which will replace public schools. And they are quite explicit about the strategy. If you Google, and the words here in itself are very interesting. If you Google the title, Flooding the Zone, you will find a text which lays out a strategy for New York City on how they will replace the existing public schools with a different school system. The strategy is that you concentrate your public school, your charter schools in three parts of the city. And I bet you could all, any of you who come to New York City could guess what these three parts of the city are. Harlem, the South Bronx, and Central Brooklyn. You may not realize this, but already today, the second biggest charter district in the United States after New Orleans is Harlem. 40% of the schools in Central Harlem are charter schools. And the strategy is that you go into the districts that historically have been ill-served because they are the poorest areas of the city. And because those students have the greatest challenges that they bring to school, and the school system has not provided the supports that can help them be successful. And in those districts, you concentrate your charter schools, and you particularly appeal to the parents who are the parents who have the most intellectual and social capital in terms of trying to do something for their children. And you bring them into the charter schools, and you eventually create a tipping point where those districts become charter districts. And from that tipping point, you then have a strategy for transforming the entire school system. Charter schools are, by and large, an urban strategy. And if you go to this text, you will see that. That strategy is hand in hand with a political strategy, and there is an organization called The Democrats for Education Reform. And I think, again, here, there is an interesting kind of left-wing corollary, which is, and this one I will actually own up to having actually pursued the strategy myself. I was never a Leninist, even though I did read my Lenin. There are many of us who became clear at a certain point in our political development that political parties in the United States had no inherent political ideological character. And that it was possible, if you want, to move into them and capture them and move them into a direction that for us would be a more progressive direction. I would say that, again, there is a bourgeois version of this which has been pursued by the hedge fund operators behind Democrats for Education Reform, who are doing precisely that with the Democratic Party. They figure that the Republican Party is a given supporter for the policies that they're pursuing, but they won't be able to be successful unless they can at least split the Democratic Party and not capture it. And so they are pursuing that political avenue at the same time that they are pursuing the strategy of concentrating charter schools and tipping public education in their direction. So all of this, which I'm sure when I go to schools and talk about this to teachers is a very sobering picture of what's happening. All of this leads us to the question, what is to be done? A phrase that just came to mind. So just as there are two axes to the charter school strategy, the education reform strategy, I think there are two main axes to how we deal with this challenge. The first is we have to fight a battle to make sure to win back the ground around charter schools. And that battle I define as charter schools must be truly public schools. They cannot be private schools that are financed with public money. To be truly public schools, they must teach all students. Part of what we were able to do in the battle in Albany around Race to the Top and raising the charter cap was actually get a number of these reforms in place. And so we're able to move in that direction. They must be transparent. They must be accountable. We must force the for-profit management companies out of them. They must be not-for-profit. So that's one element. The second element, and Michael's giving me the two-minute mark, so I'm going to finish on that. The second element is they have to be organized. We must take our lesson from what has happened to the auto workers, the steel workers. They once had their industries organized. They said these little mom and pop non-union shops are nothing to worry about. Takes too much time, takes too much effort to organize them. A non-union beachhead was created in those industries. They lost those industries. Those unions are shadows of themselves. They just try to figure out what they don't have to give up. It is an imperative, and it is an imperative not only for the future of teacher unionism, but an imperative for the future of trade unionism and the future of public education in this country, that we organize charter schools.
Again, thanks to Michael for the conference organizers for the opportunity to talk to you today about the growth of charter schools. Michael gave me a promotion. I'm now a vice president. I work at the AFT in the president's office. My work has included over the last decade or decade and a half really tracking, monitoring the growth of the charter movement, as well as I'd like to think that I helped and assisted the AFT in pivoting in our position towards organizing charter educators. I also want to mention Gene Bruskett, who's in the audience here, who recently joined the AFT staff and contributed significantly to our charter school organizing efforts, which have ramped up recently. I'm going to just try to, as opposed to, I think, the picture that Leo has so eloquently provided for you, I'm going to try to just sketch out a little bit of the national landscape, which differs in some ways from the New York City landscape. But I think that the contours, the political contours and the financial contours that Leo has laid out are very similar. The charter schools that are have grown over the last 20 years are in some ways, as Leo has described, they are publicly funded but privately operated schools. They're exempt from most regulations that bind district schools, but they're not exempt from the adequate early progress achievement dictates from the No Child Left Behind Act. It's a common misconception that they don't have to report that information or that somehow that those regs don't apply to them. However, they tend to be smaller in size. They tend to be, on average, 300 students per school. So in a lot of cases, we don't see the kinds of reports coming out of charters that we see coming out of regular public schools because the size of the subgroup is too small. Generally, they receive a charter or a contract to operate. That can come from a state authority, it can be a district school board, a state-designated not-for-profit, a variety of different ways in which this occurs, depending on the state where they're chartered. There are about 5,000 charters currently. They enroll 1.5 million students in 40 states and the District of Columbia. And as Leo pointed out, they're heavily concentrated in urban areas. This represents roughly 3% of the total U.S. K-12 student population of 48 million. So as a national phenomenon, it doesn't, you might think, why should we be concerned about this? It gets back to the flooding the zone or the issue of market share, because the charters in certain urban districts are reaching the tipping point. So you've got a city like Washington, D.C., where 34% of students are now enrolled in charter schools. So 34% of the total K-12 population that enrolls in public schools in D.C. is enrolled in charters. In New Orleans, of course, post-Katrina, 68% of students are now enrolled in charter schools. In Detroit, I believe we're up to about 32% of students enrolled in charters. And then there are smaller places like in Albany, New York, or at Dayton, Ohio, where you have a saturation level, which is, I think, we're drawing very close to it, where the regular public school system is beginning to totter and is unable to serve the needs of the regular public school students because of the impact of charter schools. Buffalo is not quite there yet, but it could potentially go in that direction in the next couple of years. The industry, if you will, is structured so that many charter schools are single entities. They've got individual boards of directors. and they do their own administrative and back office work. You know, they're community institutions that ethnic communities, neighborhood groups, and others have started with, in many cases, they're very well-intentioned. They want to serve students and families in their community in a way that they don't feel that they're being served by the regular public schools. So it's important to acknowledge that there is that element of the charter school world. And if we don't acknowledge that, we lose credibility. In many states, some states, particularly like Minnesota, where charters started, and in states where you have a fairly strong regulatory structure, you actually have many more schools like that that perhaps you know, are similar to some of the small schools or community schools that many progressives started at various points in their communities and their states. However, the dominant voice that has emerged in the last 5 to 7 years, and it, you know, you can really see it if you track the folks who were in charge of the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools and some of the other advocacy organizations. The dominant voices that have emerged are the well-financed management companies or nonprofit networks with the kind of funders that Leo mentioned. They operate groups of schools, whether that's sort of a franchise structure like KIPP, or whether that's an actual structure where the management company takes all of the revenues and runs the entire school, like Imagine, which is a for-profit headquartered in Virginia. Those are the voices that you're hearing. Those are the kinds of schools that are being pushed by the Department of Education at a national level, and also the kinds of schools that we see being touted in op-ed pages, editorials, legislative hearings, and other places. There are about 700 charters right now nationwide that are operated by major nonprofit management companies such as KIPP. That's about 16%. For-profit management companies, or EMOs, some of you recall the early days of Edison Schools. Now there are other companies that are much more prominent, such as Imagine. They operate about 600 schools, or 13% of the sort of total universe of charter schools. There are also some states where the state legislature said, you know, we're going to allow charters, but we're going to say that charter school educators are going to be represented by the union contracts in those districts in which they're located. So Wisconsin, outside of Milwaukee, all of the educators at the charter schools are represented. Maryland, including Baltimore, all the educators are represented by union contracts. Alaska, Hawaii, Kansas, a few other spatterings of places. So you actually have about 650 charters out of the entire universe that are represented by unions, some of which we've recently organized, and Camilla's gonna talk about her experience. But so about 12%, 13% of charters are actually union represented, something that the charter movement doesn't actually talk about very often because it doesn't play into their narrative very well. They don't want to say that charters do well that are union represented, and they want to talk about the fact that if charters do well, they do well because they're quote-unquote freed from union regulations and bureaucracy, stifling union contracts. The schools, as Leo said, are not spread evenly across districts and states, and there's a specific strategy to concentrate them in specific urban areas, both in terms of demand, but also the advocates see the ability to tip certain districts, such as DC, such as Detroit, such as Toledo, Cincinnati, Cleveland, and some of the smaller urban areas. They're also looking, obviously, at very high-profile school districts. Los Angeles is one of them where the percentage is not that high in terms of total student enrollment in charters, but the number of charters is the largest in the country. And there's an effort being made to follow some of what we see the strategy in New York City being, where we're flooding specific zones of LA to saturate them and move us into a setting where those kinds, where the dual, the bourgeois Leninist strategy that Leo mentioned, the dual state strategy, the creation of a parallel structure, makes the existing system impossible to economically continue. There's a guy, Andy Samarick, who's a charter advocate, who just got appointed by Brett Shungler as the new deputy superintendent of education in New Jersey. And he puts it out there. He says, we want to replace the district-based system in America's large cities with what he calls a fluid, self-improving system of charter schools. So, right. Because from a market perspective, they think it's creative destruction, right? That you can open and close schools. They don't see the harm of the kind of churn that inflicts on families and students. So what does the evidence say about charter schools? You know, are these schools actually producing the kinds of results that have been promised? And are they serving well the families that are seeking alternatives, particularly in troubled districts? Well, I think it's pretty impossible to reach any kind of specific judgment on that. There are some charters that are excellent and have excellent student achievement results, and there are some that are awful. There's a lot that are in between. The most recent credible national study, which was done by an economist who's actually fairly pro-charter at Stanford, analyzed data from about 2,400 schools in 15 states and D.C., and that is about half of all charters and 70% of the enrollment. They found that if you compared, you control for all the demographic factors, and you compare the student gains, 37% had gains that were significantly below regular public schools, 46% had gains that were no different, and only 17% showed growth that was better than the regular public schools. It's that 17% that the federal government focuses on, and that they are promoting as being the answer to closing the achievement gap between white students and students of color. There's been a rash of, I want to just touch on something that Gene has really brought to the attention of the AFT in his work. There have been a rash of corruption and mismanagement scandals that are sort of breaking through the narrative about charters. In Philadelphia, for the last year and a half, I believe, the stories are coming out one by one about charters where there are conflicts of interest, there's self-dealing between the charter operator and a subsidiary real estate company. There are, so that, you pay inflated rents or lease charges to the real estate entity. And they make additional dollars that way. There have been additional examples. So now we have, I think, in Pennsylvania, 19 charters under federal investigation. Ohio is just a hotbed of really, really disgusting charter operators, ranging from White Hats management, but run by a guy named David Brennan, to this Imagine Schools, which runs, I'd say, seven, eight, maybe 10 schools in Ohio these days, and where 98% of the dollars go right immediately to the management company, and there's absolutely no transparency in terms of how those dollars are spent. So unlike a public school budget, where you as a taxpayer can see how your money is spent because it's reported to the public and available, none of that is available, and in fact, the companies have resisted every possible effort made to make that stuff transparent. Texas, Florida, you can imagine the different kinds of financial malfeasance that we're seeing in places. But again, it's sort of scattershot, and it doesn't play into the current narrative about how charters are a silver bullet. And so you have small stories in different publications, but there isn't sort of this sense that we've created a monster here, and that many, many states have no capacity or very little capacity to regulate and oversee this sort of sector that they have allowed to flourish. One other thing I wanted to just mention before turning things over to Camilla is Leo talked about the terrific research work that the UFT has done looking at who charters are serving. And we are seeing increasing attention to that. However, again, it's important to acknowledge that charters by and large do serve large, if not larger, proportions both in districts, states, and nationally of African American students. In some places, they also serve significant portions of Latino students, although that's less the case in places like Texas and California than you might think. But the issue is really when you get down to the granular level of the most needy students. So UFT's work looking at English language learners, are they really serving? Because those kids, you know, admit they absolutely should be served, but they are more expensive to serve. So charter schools tend to have many fewer English language learners. Secondly, they tend to have many fewer free lunch kids. If you look at the number of free and reduced lunch, that is a very similar number in almost every case, in most states and in most districts. But if you just look at free lunch, which is a different number, much poorer children, that number tends to be much lower. And then special needs students. Again, if you look at the broad picture, looks fairly similar. In some cases, charters can argue they're serving more. But question is, are they serving the most expensive to educate? In DC, we recently saw some numbers. It's every child that has a private placement in the DC public schools, it costs the district $104,000 a year. So are charters serving students that are that expensive? Generally, they tend to serve what are called higher incidence disabilities, which is students who have ADD or a variety of other things which may not require them to be out of the classroom to the same extent that a much more seriously disabled kid would. So those are some of the things. It gets into the weeds, it gets granular, but it's important in understanding how this is impacting the regular public schools. I'm just going to jump to Diane Ravitch, as some of you know, has recently come out with a very, very a book that's very popular with public school teachers, and I think is creating quite a bit of commentary because she's taken her previous support for charters and other forms of choice, and she's really revised her position. She calls it the Billionaire Boys Club, and she talks about Walton, she talks about Gates, Dell, Michael Dell, the Fisher family, which owns the Gap and Banana Republic, Eli Broad, a bunch of the other big foundation folks who were out there supporting charters in many, many ways. And they've exerted a tremendous influence on the Obama administration, populating both the education department and also putting people in sort of on loan to help develop programs like Race to the Top. The AFT has responded perhaps too slowly, I think, and not recognizing that this is more than just a marginal movement, that even though it affects only 3% of students nationwide, that this is something that we have to take incredibly seriously, that this is has a, as Leo I think laid out, has a clear strategy behind it to undermine not only public education, but unions. And in the original conception, that Shanker put forward, the late AFT president. Michael mentioned to me the other night that he may have been at the AFT convention where Shanker talked about this. Charters were meant to be an innovative effort by public education to set up sort of laboratories, schools within schools, where you could innovate on instruction, innovate perhaps on labor relations, innovate in a variety of ways, experiment, and then share those practices widely with all public schools. So this vision has clearly been hijacked by this billionaire boys club, and the AFT has been responding in several different ways. First, we fought for the policies that Leo mentioned, the accountability, transparency, the equity, which I think NYSA has succeeded and UFT has succeeded in winning some major gains on. We're not there in terms of many other states, but we are working hard in that effort. We're organizing charter school educators, which is something that has taken quite a long time for our locals to begin to embrace, to say we represent people who teach in schools, whatever those schools are, any publicly funded schools in these major cities, that's who we represent, and we've got to go out and organize those folks. And then I think that the lastly, AFT is out there fighting on a set of reforms that we think will actually result in strengthening public education. And Leo can talk more about those, and Camilla, as we get into questions, but I think that we have some answers. They're not magic bullets. I think anybody who's an educator knows there isn't a magic bullet, but the kinds of things that we're advocating are the kinds of things that we think will go a long way to creating the conditions for teaching and learning that students and teachers need.
Good morning. Thank you to Jean and Nancy and Leo, and also to you for inviting me today. Can you guys hear me? A little bit closer? Okay. Well, I can talk loud because I teach, so. Nancy just mentioned the start and the reasons and the purpose of charter schools. Originally, they were teacher-driven. And I am a product of the major school model. Any of you who are from Maryland, you probably have heard of Betty Dispenza Green. She successfully adopted the mini school model where you were a student who chose a major and you had a school within the school. And in my high school, we had about 6 different majors you could choose. That was kind of a start, I believe, of adopting the charter school model where charter schools say that they will do something specific that other schools do not do. And this basically is the premise that the hijackers have used. Choice. Diversity, equity in education, competitive alternatives to public schools, rigor. The terms academy and college prep used very loosely. These were the terms used at the forefront of pushing the charter school rules agenda. I witnessed the effects of inadequate schools, resources that public schools just did not have. I have always worked with a school that was walking distance from a Chicago public project. And so I saw students with great potential, however, there was something missing. The motivation wasn't there, the resources weren't there, they did not know. And I, too, fell for the choice factor. The ideology of choice is what attracted and still attracts parents today. Choice is a key term, however, few parents, teachers, politicians, and students took the time to really ask what choices they were being given. The charter school movement has successfully adopted a model to allow schools to fail so that the only thing they have to choose are what we offer them, which is privatization and charter schools. My background is in student development. I have 12 years of experience working with students that have been volunteering with youth since
since I was 13 years old at the YMCA. I believe there was a better way to fix education, and I thought that the charter school option would possibly be one of the ways to repair education. I'm a fan of Jonathan Kozol, have been reading him for years, and for the life of me, I do not understand how he has written so many books, but yet no one in administration politically has stopped to listen to what he said. He started his first book looking at the projects in Chicago, and the same disparities that occurred then in the late 70s still occur today. I understand that the charter, I understood the charter schools would pay me less, and they sell that as I'm doing a good deed. We can't afford to pay you what we pay regular school teachers because we don't have the same access. Having unionized, I realized that they had more access than most public schools have. I learned that while I started this journey and was told that I would be able to be innovative, I would have a voice, I would be able to develop curriculum, that when I chose to speak up about some of the things that I saw that were incorrect, my voice was not listened to. No one wanted to hear what my thoughts or ideals were, and they didn't want to hear what my colleagues' thoughts or ideals were. We then became the troublemakers. We were to do what we were told and not to use the education that we received to educate students. Many teachers, including myself, held two award degrees, and we learned that our counterparts, our superiors, did not. It is not a requirement in charter schools for those who are in administration to hold a Type 75 and maybe something different here in New York, but that's basically certification stating that you understand education policy, you understand school finance, you understand curriculum development, and you must have all of these things in order to run a school. Currently, the high school that I am at, I don't have a principal. They fired her because she was not willing to let go of the teachers that the CEO wanted to let go, and so she was fired. She had 25 years of experience, had been a principal in another school for 5 years, and she was close to retirement, so it wasn't a problem for them to let her go. We were told this in April and was told that they would not hire anyone new until sometime in August. So we've been operating with the CEO and a chief academic officer, which is a creative position, which is another CEO, they run the school pretty much. We see them every other day, they share the responsibility, and that's what's happening currently in the school that I am in. I want to give you an abbreviated version of what I've dealt with the last 2 years of my life. In 2008, summer, I started a new position at Civitas School. Now, Civitas School is a partner EMO with Chicago International Charter School. And as I was sitting here listening to Leo and to Nancy, I was thinking, how can I explain to them without confusing them totally what an EMO is? It's an education management company. Now, in Chicago, in 2007, there was an initiative that they started in 2005 to push this Renaissance 2010 initiative, which is a pretty much cut-paste model of Race to the Top. The Renaissance 2010 model basically said we want to create 100 new charter campuses. Not charter schools, but charter campuses. You can have a charter school that has multiple campuses. In Chicago right now, there are in Illinois, 50% of the charter schools in Illinois are in the Chicagoland Cook County District, which is the largest county in the state. For the last 6 years, Senator Lightfoot and Senator Beeks have been trying to redistrict funding in education. It has gone nowhere. No one is willing to give up funds to help the poorest county in the state. So I started this new job, and I learned that I was a part of CICS, which is Chicago International Charter School, and part of Civitas School. CICS has a charter for the state. They have 12 schools in the state. What they decided to do was, they decided to basically cut the pie up and give it to EMOs to run the schools. So if all of these tables in this room were in the CICS network, CICS got to the point where they couldn't fund the schools by themselves. they decided to give Nancy Van Meter Schools a call and say, we've got some schools that we want you to partner with us. And what you can do is you can create this board of directors full of billionaires and billionaires and hedge funds, and you can have them to help pay your salary. And what we will do, I will get all 90% of the funding to fund these schools from the government. And at the end of it, you can actually pocket about $3 or $4 million, because you don't have to spend all the funds that the state gives you. And the money that you're making from the hedge funds and the stock market, you can just pocket that and create your own little endowment. That's what they did. So then they had Nancy buy some schools up, and then they said, oh, hey, Leo, we got some schools. Pick which ones you want. And so we have one charter network that has 5 different EMOs, and they compete against each other. Education Management Organization. They're not called a company. They're an organization, but they're for profit. And this is what is happening in the school that I'm in. Parents are unaware of it. Teachers became aware of it as we started to organize. We organized under the radar. My school is an advocate of ACT testing. Their motto and their purpose of their charter says that they will score higher, the students will score higher on the ACT test compared to regular Chicago public school students by the junior year if you go to the school. So we did skill drill all day, every day, all year long. We were told that if we did not teach to the test, that we would be fired. If the scores did not increase, we would not receive bonuses. And if we did, we would receive bonuses. All of this was told to us at the beginning of the year. Midway through the year, they fired the CEO when they heard that we were organizing. We presented them with papers on the day of spring break. They fired our CEO the day before the spring break. They then fired our principal. They fired a principal at another campus. They fired our vice principal. And so our school was this model that was supposed to compete with the alternative education, which was a regular public school system. We have 3 campuses. Elementary school is on the south side, a high school on the south side, and one school is on the north side. We had never communicated with each other, even though we were all under the same network, which is what they wanted. But when we got to talking, we realized we were all dealing with the same things, and that's how we were so great in organizing and building a strong foundation. We were promised by the new CEO, who I like to call the Tom Cruise of education. He's a charming guy. He came in, he batted his eyes, he smiled at all the young teachers and said, give us a chance. They gave us a pizza party and told us if we get to 1 year, they'll let us have our union. And they gave us this pizza party a week before. They then decided, well, we are not going to give you the raises we told you we're going to give you, because we didn't understand the old CEO's model. So we're going to give everybody a 4% increase, and you should be happy with that. So all of this happened. We had a high turnover in teachers. There has not been 1 year in the school that I'm at where there has been less than 30% of teacher turnover. This year alone, we are at the brink of 50%, around 48% of teacher turnover. We did successfully go through the process to unionize. They challenged us. Now here's where it gets interesting. They challenged the union and said that we could not be a union under Illinois law. That they were a private school, we had to be a union under the national law. However, they received 90% of public funds. They received money to the CICS network, who then takes that money and gives it to the EMO. And the EMO manages and runs the schools. So we're trying to figure out, how is it you're private when it's a public school? They hired a firm that has on its website, We Bust Up Union, and had their rank of a, I want to say it was a 98 percentile winning rate of their cases where companies started to unionize.
You lowered it considerably.
Oh, it's lower. Well, it's lower now. I have to find out what the new rate is for you guys. So this is the company that they hired. We went to the board hearing, went through the process. We were hoping and praying that we could get it done before the end of the school year. We were really hoping that it didn't go over. What happened was we voted, and the vote was on the last day of school. So we really had to push to organize and to get everyone out to vote, and we did vote, and we did win it, and then we started the process of our contract in July of last year. The contract process went from July through October, and we ratified in October. So we did complete the process. There are some challenges that we're still having. They have allowed that probationary period to be what they're going to use to fire teachers to create this chaos where teacher turnover rate is still really high. There are other organizations and other charters who have partnered with us to help unionize other schools. There's a school, Aspira, that has organized, and they have five schools, and they're the most recent to organize. There's another school, Union Park, which is organized as well. So the charter school organized school system is growing. However, there was one particular school that was organizing for assisting with ACT charter, and I previously worked at ACT years ago, and they started to organize, they got scared. Their CEO is a former employee of KIPP, and I think everyone here is familiar with KIPP schools. And he made them some promises and, you know, really convinced them that they would not be able to do what they had been doing in the school if they had organized. So they backed off. A week after they backed off, they got notice that their school was closing. There are charter school CEOs who have blatantly told teachers, we will shut this school down before we allow you to organize. We will sell the school to another EMO before we allow you to organize. And we put in our contract that if they decide to sell our school to another EMO, the contract goes with them. And so that's something that a lot of people are very unaware of. I mentioned the Renaissance 2010 program. I just want to read to you and tell me if this sounds like Race to the Top. Every new school is held accountable for a five-year performance plan or agreement. Every school's achievement is measured to standards of set of metrics beyond the test score. Schools enjoy freedom over curriculum, length of the school day, school year, and budget. The goal is for test scores, parent involvement, high attendance, low mobility rate, low teacher turnover, high graduation rate, high college attendance. Low performance gains are what they're trying to combat. They need schools to close in order to open new schools. That's what's happening all over America. It's happening rapidly in Chicago because we have a mayor who has full control of the school system, who wants charter schools, whose friends are on the boards of most of these charter schools, and they have money at stake in the school system. We're here to talk about class in America and how all of this relates to class. I'm a teacher who has been observed, I believe, 27 times this school year alone. When I started to organize, I was observed every single day by everyone in the administration, even people who I didn't even know who they were coming to observe me. There were scare tactics along the way. I wasn't afraid. I'm a byproduct of a father who is from the union, a mother who was in the union. So my dad's IBEW. I'm not really concerned with the scare tactics. But those scare tactics started to affect my students and started to cause chaos in my classroom. Kids would be questioned and things like that. This affects class because they are systematically trying to detach teachers who really care about education, teaching students, teachers who are going to teach social development or consciousness. They don't want them. They cause chaos in administration. Where it's constant turnover, they cause chaos in the school building so that teachers aren't there to mentor new teachers coming in. And at the end, what really happens is the effects all go down to the student. So students come out of high school not prepared, they're not motivated, they're probably not gonna vote, they're probably gonna get a job and realize that they're competing with their grandparents and their parents for the same jobs now. And all of this really helps to increase the poverty level because you have students who are unprepared and uneducated. You have to weaken the profession and then you get to weaken the student. And that's what's happening in education. And that's why it's important for us to unionize charters and to press legislators to unionize charters, because I strongly believe, God is my witness, that if we said it's okay to have a charter school, but they must be unionized, the EMOs would pick up and leave and they would find them a new public sector to go after. They would not bother. But because they are making lots of money at the government's expense, at the youth's expense, at urban America's expense, they're going to continue to use flashy cards and memorabilia and all those things to attract and tell us that we have a choice, and we have to start asking, what are the choices that we're choosing from? Thank you.
Thank you all very much. This is just terrific. We have a schedule to keep, and I think our panelists are going to be around for a little while through the morning, through lunch. You can find them and talk about these issues. I just want to say a couple things before we get to a couple of announcements and then we're done. I remember that speech that Al Shanker gave at the AFT convention in the 1980s, and I had my differences with the Shanker regime on a number of questions, but I listened to that speech as a delegate, and I thought, that's really smart. And what he was saying was, the public schools are in trouble. Children are not learning. We have to take that on as a challenge as teachers, because somebody, if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it and tell us what to do. We are the professionals, we are teachers, and we need to create environments in which we can, as professionals, as people who understand what the needs of our children are, where we can experiment and make new adjustments and find out what works and then spread that around the public school system. That was a way of understanding that if we don't do it, we're going to be subject to the discipline of the school boards, to the school management, and we're going to be just told what to do. And I thought that was pretty interesting. Leo's formulation of bourgeois Leninism, which I just think is terrific, and I'm going to hold on to that, brings to mind another thing that I just have to tell you. I was at a conference on collective bargaining in higher education at CUNY in Baruch College, which is a business-oriented college. They have a center for the study of collective bargaining in higher education. And they have annual conferences. And I went to one from UUP back in the 90s, early 90s. And it was focused on technology in higher education. This was the beginning of distance learning, beginning of all this stuff about how you could do things with electronics and with the new technology. And the keynote speaker was the president of the University of Phoenix. Now, the University of Phoenix is a for-profit, online, public, private educational initiative. And the president comes, he's an academic, very natty, dressed, you know, like a corporate executive, and he stands up and he says to the assembled, I don't usually agree with Karl Marx, but, and he opens up the Communist Manifesto, and he starts reading, for those of you who may remember, there's a passage at the beginning of the Communist Manifesto in which Marx and Engels talk about the revolutionary character of capitalism, right? And how capitalism sweeps away all the old feudal structures. And then it ends that long passage with all that is sacred, right, vanishes into thin air. So this guy stands and he reads this passage verbatim. He closes it up, he looks around, and he says, I'm here to tell you that capitalism has come to higher education. And all that is sacred will vanish into thin air. Got our attention. These people know. And they have figured out, or they are trying to figure out, how to come and get us. Just like they're figuring out how to come and get working people all over the country and all over the world. And what we've heard here is one little piece, extremely significant piece, for us as educators, of how we have to answer that. And that bourgeois-Leninism, we're going to hold on to that. We need our own. If Como Boyraz is here, Samo Boyraz, Myra Lake.